This is Stuart Molina, podcasting from my home office, and talking about the major work of the second half of our second Masterworks program, Nielsen's Fourth Symphony, The Inextinguishable. And before anything else, let me talk a little bit about that title. Some people approach inextinguishable as an adjective, that it's an inextinguishable symphony. But actually, Nielsen thinks of the inextinguishable as a noun. And the inextinguishable is the force of humanity that will remain even if the rest of the world is destroyed. Were the entire world to disappear, the yearnings, the hopes, the passion of mankind would still somehow spring forth. And this is the thought that is behind the entire symphony. It's very important to put this symphony into its historical perspective. This piece was written during World War I, where the world was quite literally falling apart, and there was a question as to whether the world would destroy itself. And so this piece, I think, is an amazingly powerful statement during this desolate time, first of all as a musical statement of the desolation, but also as a reason to rejoice, for the human spirit emerges at the end of this piece as inevitably triumphant over the forces that seek to destroy it. So how does Nielsen portray this struggle between the destructive forces and the forces of the human spirit, this inextinguishable, the force that will come back no matter what happens? He does this in a number of ways. The first is through a couple of harmonic struggles. One is the struggle between the tritone and the perfect fifth. The tritone is just one half step less than the span of a fifth. This is the tritone. And this is a perfect fifth. Now, earlier on in music history, the tritone was known as the devil in music. And in fact, it was forbidden in church worship for a long time. You couldn't use this tritone, this devil's interval. Of course, by the time we've reached the 20th century, it's commonplace. But Nielsen uses it in the symphony with such insistence and so much contrasting the use of the open fifth in other sections that it becomes a real motive unto itself. The other harmonic struggle that we're going to hear is the struggle of a half step. A half step is the distance on a piano between a white key and the black key above it, let's say. And we have two of these half steps in play here. One is the third degree of the scale, which is the degree that determines whether a chord will be minor or major. A minor chord has a lower pitched third degree. A major chord has a higher pitched third degree. And that struggle between a major third and a minor third, we're going to hear quite a lot of. And finally, the seventh degree of a scale. Your normal major scale has a high, sharp seventh degree. That's your diatonic scale. Now, we can also lower that seventh degree, and it puts it into what's called the mixolydian mode. And this is used a lot by composers. But this as well we're going to hear quite a lot, and I'll show you some examples in a little bit. Nielsen sets up all of these struggles in the very opening phrase. Now, this is pretty typical. Nielsen is all about taking an idea and developing it in an overarching sweep through the course of a piece. And at the very beginning of the piece, we have, in the woodwinds, first a minor chord followed by a major chord very quickly. And then this is followed by a tritone figure. And at the same time, the timpani, one of two timpani players that Nielsen uses in this piece, is banging away a tritone in the lower range. So, we have our struggle between the half step of the third degree, major and minor, and we have our tritone, which is going to be a major force of destruction and evil throughout this piece. The opening of this symphony is extremely powerful, extremely emotional, and I think coming out of the simple world of the Poulenc and the Vivaldi with their small ensembles, it's going to be an incredibly powerful moment in this concert when we hear this explosion at the beginning of the Fourth Symphony of Nielsen. After a fairly quick section of storm and destruction, we hear the emergence of our inextinguishable theme. We hear it first in the clarinets, and in contrast with the tritones that we've been hearing, this is very much set in a major key, and this is that theme. Contrast is pretty extraordinary. There is one spot in this section that I would like to point out where we hear what I was talking about with the lowering of the seventh degree of the scale. Towards the end of this section, we'll hear music that sounds like this. Scale, but we're getting this G natural, which is a very Mixolydian kind of sound, and we're going to get more of that as the piece progresses. Soon after we hear this theme for the first time, we're going to hear it transformed into something more exultant, something more jubilant, and almost leaning into frenetic. And you'll hear it with the full orchestra, and this is what that will sound like. So, what we had before as... it's the same material we get now, but it's much more exciting. Etc. And then, the music will get even grander, as we have the full orchestra playing in its full sonic capacity that simple melody from the clarinets, which brings the first section of the first movement to a close. The development section of the first movement is rather strange and almost feels like we're wandering. The music becomes much more of a question mark. There's no real sense of what key we're in, where we're heading. We just have a simple meandering chromatic melody in the violins. And so on. But every so often it will be interrupted by a very strong rhythmic statement of just one note in the violas. Starting very fast and slowing down. And we'll hear this again and again. Remember that because it's going to come back in a different form in the third movement. Soon we have the return of this minor major bit from the very beginning in the low strings. And the tritone. And then again. Minor then major then tritone. And of course, it's going to explode into more destructive music, and the destructive music eventually is going to give way. But first, before the grand statement at the end of this movement, we have almost a desperate attempt for our theme to emerge. We hear the music get very busy and soon become a section of falling harmonies that sounds like this. And then we hear the clarinets playing the theme. But this will be interrupted again. Now we'll hear the oboes. And that's interrupted, etc. And we'll have these little interruptions of our theme desperately trying to emerge against the unpleasant, destructive music around it. Finally, everything calms down. And we do have a return of our opening melodies, a beautiful section where our inextinguishable theme comes in little bursts in the woodwinds against a very simple, almost flowing accompaniment in the strings. And finally, at the end of this movement, we have the to date most exultant and grand statement of our main theme. The second movement of the Inextinguishable Symphony provides a complete contrast to what we've had in the first movement. As overblown and dramatic as the first movement was, so is the second movement intimate, introspective, and understated. It's a very simple, folky melody that we hear in the woodwinds to start. Serves almost as a foil to the first movement. In the first movement, we have huge forces of good and evil. In the second movement, it's about simple people. It's very much a human movement. And the simplicity after the craziness of the first movement is extremely effective. I'm not going to talk too much about this movement because it's very straightforward. I will, however, say that at the end of this movement, again, we get this reminder that all is not necessarily well. And we hear it in arpeggios that come from the woodwinds. And when we get to the clarinet, it's a simple alternation of a seventh and a fifth degree. Again, that lowered seventh that I spoke about from the Mixolydian mode. Repeats it. And the movement dies away. We hear an extended unison note in the violins that lasts a long time, and suddenly we find ourselves in a very dramatic, very stark third movement. It's a melody of great drama in the violins, accompanied by a duet of unison notes in the timpani and in the low strings. This is just an idea of what that will sound like. Thank you. and so on. There are a few elements of this melody that I do want to point out because Nielsen is going to make use of them. One is this figure. He's going to change that quite a bit as we go on, and you'll hear it as, or in various parts of the orchestra. The other is this melody towards the end of the excerpt I played. The reason why this is of interest to me is because it's going to also be expanded into and used as a fugue melody later in this movement. This, in my mind, comes out of that viola part that we heard earlier. I do think that there's a connection there in Nielsen's mind. At any rate, after this violin melody, the violas come in and play the same melody in counterpoint with the violins, and after that, we get, again, a different world of sound. Solo strings, meaning just one player from each section, playing together in a very tonal, very beautiful E major section, and this is what that melody sounds like. Sounds like something that Leonard Bernstein would write. There's kind of a jazzy sound to it. What this is once again that major minor third struggle. Listen one more time. Minor, major. So he's now taken this element of music from the first movement and turned it into a melodic motive in the third movement. Accompanying this melody is our little snippet of a theme that I mentioned before. And we're going to hear these two melodies working with each other once again. This will then be interrupted by the emergence of that expanded second melody. Etc. And this is what the rest of this movement is going to be made of. We're going to have a rather extensive fugue built on that theme in all the various instruments, and then the slightly jazzy major minor theme is going to emerge against that in the brasses, in the trombone, and in the horns. Meanwhile, the accompaniment is going to get busier and busier using and becoming this. Clearly we're in minor, and then we're going to be in major. And this is the emotional peak of the third movement. The third movement ends quietly with the oboe plaintively intoning that repetitive theme. But something is abuzz, something is exciting, and immediately the orchestra explodes into the last movement, again connected as the other three movements were, with a series of fast scale motion violin lines. Etc., etc. And this builds an excitement as the lower instruments come in and the whole string section is playing fast scales. And then we're in the last movement in its full majesty. The beginning of the last movement is, again, exultant, extremely joyful. And here, too, we get that strange Mixolydian sound in the main theme, which is this. Seventh, we hear once again, and it feels part of the piece, and we know what it's about. We've heard it before. This last movement, more than any of the others, is about the struggles between chaos and destruction and human triumph. And we hear most pronouncedly the destructive elements in the timpani. This is the part of the symphony that is probably most famous and most important in terms of its place in the repertoire. Nielsen has two timpanists playing together, and they're both playing tritones extremely loudly. And in fact, he writes a note in the orchestra saying that the music that the timpani plays from this point on should be menacing, and it should be extremely strong and noticeable even when it's playing soft. So here we have this menacing presence under the surface. Sometimes it takes over in the orchestra, and sometimes it's drowned out by joyful music in the orchestra. But suffice it to say, the music does eventually end triumphant. It's a very fantastic finale. I'm not spending nearly enough time on it, but I actually would like for the audience to hear it without any preconceived notions. You have all of the elements, the things that you're going to hear. The inextinguishable theme will return very strongly first in the brasses and then triumphantly in the full orchestra as the piece comes to a close. One last word on this piece, in that historically this was a period of time that produced some unbelievably great music with similar themes, the theme of human triumph over adversity. And it's no great wonder, given what was going on in the world in the first four decades of this century, between World War I, with its almost senseless and unending human destruction, and World War II, with its unbelievably cruel and inhuman destruction. And meanwhile, artists were continuing to make music. They were creating works of art, and these works represented the world around them. And the world was not a pretty one. And yet somehow the music of Nielsen, the music of Shostakovich, the music of these great composers who worked under a great deal of adversity, their music remains triumphant. And that's why I think it's still so powerful today. I do hope you will enjoy this second Masterworks concert.